Well, hello again to everybody out in Turdville. It is Thursday, and you know what Thursday is in Turdville. It is Access to Access Day. And today I'm really excited about this particular episode in that our guest today is the one and only James Turk, who many of you know as the original founder of GoldMoney.com, which is one of our affiliations here. And gold money is just fantastic, whether you're just looking to purchase some metal or whether you want to vault some metal outside of your current country of residence. Gold money is a great place to go. But James is a fantastic voice for our, I guess we'll call it, gold bug world. So, James, anyway, hey, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, no, it's good to be with you here in Turdville.
James, before we get started, why don't you, in your own words, tell everybody a little bit about Gold Money and the business.
Yeah, we launched it, now 13 years ago, back in 2001. It's an online way to purchase precious metals and to store precious metals in vaults located in 5 different countries, operated by 7 different companies. So it's a great way of owning physical precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, and palladium. We're presently storing about $1.5 billion worth of precious metals. That's owned by approximately 24,000 different individuals around the world.
A tremendous responsibility, but a great service, and increasingly valuable as time marches on, obviously. James, I want to just kind of dive right in. And I've just got a couple of questions before we get to the subscriber questions and the listener questions. You know, the big thing as we record this, it's about 2:00 Eastern on Thursday, and the situation in Ukraine, you know, vis-a-vis Russia and China and everybody else, is continuing to move in a very interesting direction. I just wanted to get your thoughts on that and how you see it impacting the price of gold here in the short term.
Yeah, you know, it's just another bullish factor for gold. You know, the main reason why the gold price is rising is very basic, very simple. It's central bank money printing, or what they now call quantitative easing. You know, as currencies are debased, the gold price rises in terms of that nominal currency. But the interesting thing is that because gold is money, its purchasing power doesn't change. So, you know, here's gold at $1,350 compared to where it was, you know, any time over the past several decades. But it still buys basically the same amount of crude oil it did over, you know, any of that period of time. And the same thing with silver. You know, I like to use the example that when I was a kid growing up in Ohio, my parents could drive into the local gas station and fill up the family car with 2 silver dollars. Today, you can still fill up the family car with the content of 2 silver dollars, but not $2 in paper. So, you know, gold and silver do what they're supposed to do. They preserve money. They preserve purchasing power over long periods of time. That's one of the most important functions is money. So you have to start out by looking at gold as money, not as an investment, because you're not actually increasing your wealth. You know, gold doesn't generate cash flow. It's just preserving your purchasing power over long periods of time. And it's a great place to be when there are monetary problems around the world, which is what we have, or geopolitical problems around the world, which seem to be worsening.
Absolutely. You know, I just spent over an hour this morning speaking with Jim Willey. You probably know who Jim is, right?
Yes, I do.
And we were talking about the long-term implications of all this. And, you know, the demand of China, from China for gold is now well documented, and the gold flowing out of London through Switzerland into China and other parts in the Eastern Hemisphere. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about what is ultimately going to become of that, whether it'll be whether China might back their currency with gold, or whether working together with Russia and the other creditor nations, whether they'd back something with gold. Jim Willey's big thing is a gold-based trade settlement system in the future. Yet, I mean, kind of from a big picture standpoint, James, which one of those is more likely? What do you think might be coming?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. We have five different potential scenarios in the book as to how it's going to play out. In terms of what's happening to the dollar, I think the dollar's in the early stages of what Ludwig von Mises of the Austrian school called a crack-up boom, and you're starting to see a flight out of the currency, which we can talk about in greater detail. But on a geopolitical level, I tend to think that China is at some point in time going to take control rather than being on the receiving end. It's using the international monetary system now to its advantage. It's accumulating real assets, not just gold, but any kind of resource it can get its hands on and spend its dollars on. And as a consequence of that, I think China at some point in time probably will go to a gold-backed currency when it's ready to make that decision. And that could be happening sooner rather than later. So that seems to me to be a likely scenario, a gold-backed currency coming from China.
And that, when you say sooner rather than later, that's one of the blowback things that may very well be coming because of this Ukrainian situation. But that's something we're all keeping an eye on. And you mentioned the book, and I neglected to point this out in your introduction. You'll see in a link here on the podcast page, everyone, a link to James's new book that he co-wrote with John Rubino called The Money Bubble and What to Do Before It Pops. In terms of, I'll just ask you about that title, James, just as a lead-in to the book, which is fantastic. And the information in there is fresh. It's as if you just wrote it last week. What do you, what, explain the title, The Money Bubble. What do you mean by that? And what to do before it pops?
Yeah, everybody has a pretty good conception of what a bubble is these days. We can read about it in history and talk about the South Sea Bubble or the Mississippi Bubble, which happened a couple hundred years ago, or we can bring it more recent and look at the dot-com bubble or the real estate bubble. When you're in a bubble, there's a certain statement that's accepted as a conventional wisdom, but it's not really analyzed or thought through logically. And so, but after the bubble pops, everybody realizes how silly it was. So, for example, in the dot-com bubble, everybody was saying that profits don't matter, only market share does. When that bubble popped, everybody realized how stupid that conventional wisdom in quotes, was. At the real estate bubble, everybody was saying housing prices only go up. After that bubble popped, everybody realized how silly that was. With the money bubble, everybody thinks national currencies are money, but in fact, they're just a money substitute circulating in place of money. And this is the conventional wisdom that I think is going to ultimately be realized is incorrect when this money bubble pops. And we thought, John and I thought it was going to happen within a few years after our first book. And back in 2004, we said basically two themes: buy gold and bet against the housing bubble and financial stocks. And that was among the best investment advice in the decade. And when 2008 came along, we thought, okay, well, this is going to be it. But they managed to keep the system going. They managed to keep the dollar in the air by this unprecedented amount of money printing. This time around, I think we're going to see another 2008 replay, but they won't be able to keep it together anymore because interest rates are already at zero. The debt levels are already huge. And this time around, the money bubble will pop. And we're going to go back to some form of, sound money, gold and/or silver circulating in payments.
And with the subtitle, What to Do Before It Pops, I would say it certainly makes it required reading for everybody. And I would encourage everyone to purchase it. And I'd say it's even one of those books, like when I first read Peter Schiff's first book back in whatever it was, 2007. I mean, I instantly bought a couple extra copies and handed them out to people because I thought, this is, people need to know this information. I'd say the same thing about this new book of yours. It's just fantastic.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
James, I want to kind of dive in. I've got so many questions in queue. I think we better get started and just dive right in. So I'll go straight to the first one. Comes from a guy who calls himself Steve O. And it's kind of blends in my last question. And my last question was just going to be about the benefits of global vaulting. A lot of folks are in the US or in the EU area, and the benefits of getting it out of your, where they might be coming for it someday. And that's a little bit of Steve-O's question. He wants to know, how safe is real allocated physical held outside of one's domicile should the excrement hit the fan?
Yeah, that's a good question. There are two things you really have to look at. The first is, what is the governance procedures that the company is using to give you the assurances of integrity that your precious metals are safe when they're being stored for you? And what we do in Gold Money is we have regular audits. We have a very disciplined procedure in terms of governance procedures that we discuss on our website. We even go to the extent that every gold bar that comes into the system, we use GE Technologies ultra scanning to make sure that this is a pure gold bar and that there are no foreign materials embedded into the center of it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's the first element of it. The second element is, which country do you want to store? And, you know, given that the future is unpredictable, we don't know how it's going to play out. But the best way to respond to a future that cannot be predicted, what you need to do is diversify as much as possible. So you spread, your nest eggs around in different locations and in different places. And what I'm getting at is, you use a different geographical location and a different political system. So, you know, people might not be comfortable with storing in London, for example, if you live in the States, because you think London might be too comfortable or too close, to U.S. control. But, you know, Hong Kong, for example, that's an entirely different political system, a political jurisdiction. It's under the control of China. You know, Singapore is another different, jurisdiction. So you want to diversify geographically, and you want to diversify into different political systems in order to mitigate the risk of capital controls confiscation, which brings up one last important point. In the 1933 gold confiscation in the U.S., gold that was owned by Americans outside of the United States was not confiscated. Only gold that was within the United States was confiscated. And, you know, who's to say it might be different this time around, but at least there's a precedent of showing that, you know, global diversification is an important way to mitigate the risks of confiscation, capital controls, and all of the other things that politicians can do to the free markets.
And the you mentioned earlier the different places where vaulting is available with gold money. Hit those spots again, James.
Yeah, Canada, London, Switzerland, Hong Kong, in Singapore, and we use five different companies. Five companies. There's seven different vaults that you can choose in those five different countries.
And it brings up a side point. I had a friend of mine on a couple weeks ago by the name of Josh Fair, who runs the Scottsdale Mint down in Scottsdale, Arizona. And his company has a big role within the new Singapore Metals Exchange. And one of his things he really wanted to touch upon when we spoke and did one of these webinars was how pervasive some of the counterfeiting is he's seeing in coins and bars worldwide. You mentioned what you guys do with all your technology to verify everything, isn't salted and things like that. How pervasive do you think that problem is, James?
You know, it's hard to say. We have relationships with the major refineries in Switzerland, and they do the bulk of the gold refining around the world. And they do get, an occasional bar that is, got a tungsten content or something like that. But it's very, very rare.
Okay.
Now, our own experience is that when we announced this scanning, ultrasound scanning of all of the gold within Gold Money, we went back and scanned every bar, which at that time was something like 1,300 or 1,400 LBMA good delivery bars, which weigh approximately 400 ounces. And there were about six or eight bars that were questionable, that didn't pass the scan. So what we did is we melted those bars down with the Swiss refiners and had them recast. And the weight of gold in those old bars was exactly the same as what was originally stamped on those bars. The reason why those bars did not pass the ultra scan is because a lot of the older bars were refined and cast with a technology from the 1960s or the 1970s, and it didn't give a good picture on the ultrascan machine. So, you know, as far as gold money is concerned, we've never had a gold bar, you know, come through to us that didn't, that had any kind of foreign material in it. And by talking to the refiners, it's actually, you know, pretty rare. But it does happen. And what dealers do is typically if they take anything larger than a coin, they won't give you the value for it immediately. What they'll do is they'll say that they will refine it and then pay you based on the content in that bar after the refining results, because otherwise it's just too much risk.
Yeah.
If you're taking a kilo bar or something of that nature.
Yeah.
Which is, again, this is another thing, you know, about, you know, physical metal. And you know my point of view that what you really need is physical metal, because it's only a tangible asset that provides a safe haven. But when it comes to physical metal, there are only two ways to buy it. You buy it and you store it yourself, or you buy it and you have someone store it for you, like what we're doing in gold money. Again, looking at diversification, I really recommend both. You know, have some gold at home, or have some gold, you know, stored, you know, at some friend's or family's house, but also have some gold stored in other locations too. You know, if you have one of the disadvantages, for example, of storing it yourself, is if it's a larger bar, it'll have to be refined. There's the inconvenience of going to the store, to the coin shop, and, you know, all of that kind of stuff. Whereas you do have the advantage of, you know, having it at hand. In gold money, you don't have it at hand because it's stored for you in vaults around the world. But you have immediate access to that. You could sell your gold or silver or platinum or palladium at any time and have the proceeds immediately wired to your bank account anywhere in the world. So, you know, again, everything has a trade-off. But, you know, I really recommend looking at both alternatives. You know, have some metal at hand nearby where you live, but also have, in my view, more of your metal stored for you internationally with a professional storage firm that has good governance procedures.
Makes sense to me. No question about it. All right, I'll move on to the next question. And these might kind of jump around a little bit, but that's kind of how the format flows, James. This one comes from a guy by the name of Vic. He wants to know, why is it logical, and I don't know if I'd say it is logical, but why is it logical to think that the eventual true valuation of the metals will occur rationally or orderly? That is a nice, smooth, boring progression higher. Rather, why not expect a massive readjustment, maybe even overnight, to reflect the actual reality of a fair value for gold? That would also mean that the average person never has a chance to wake up and get on the train. You know, it just happens overnight. I mean, do you see one way or another, I guess, being more likely?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's something that I think about a lot. You know, over the last 12 years, 13 years, the price has risen more or less fairly consistently. You know, it's up 14% per annum on average over that 13-year period stretch, even with last year being a down year. Because the people that are intervening in the market to keep the gold price from rising are letting it rise a little bit every year in order to release the pressure that occurs when they're debasing the currency. You know, if you're going to debase the currency, the gold price has to rise. You know, that's a fact of life, because gold and dollars are basically substitutes for one another. So you've had this managed retreat, is what I call it, over the last 13 years. But that doesn't mean that the managed retreat will continue, you know, next month or next year. I mean, it's quite possible that some moment in time you could see a blow up in the gold price, where it just soars, either because the market is responding or because some government chooses that, you know, this is complete folly the way the monetary system is structured now. We want to go back to gold, and we're going to go back to gold at some price like $8,000 an ounce, or what I think would be fair value, which is presently about $12,000 an ounce. And, you know, so gold might just go from, you know, some level, like a few thousand dollars to $12,000 essentially overnight, because the government needed it. In fact, that's what happened in the 1930s. You know, Roosevelt confiscated all the gold, which was worth $20.67 per ounce at the time, devalued the dollar to $35. He did it over a few months, but, you know, he devalued the dollar. and gold was now worth $35 per ounce instead of $20.67 an ounce. So if you had to ask me which one is more likely, I think you're going to see gold rise for a period of time under this managed retreat mode, but essentially, because it's a fractional reserve system where there's more paper claims to gold than physical gold actually exists, at some point you're going to see a massive jump. If you go back to 1979, in September of 1979, gold was $340 an ounce. 3 months later, it was $800 an ounce. This time around, the percentage gains are going to be even bigger when you're in the final blow-off stage, and that's when the money bubble pops.
Well, and that kind of leads into, I guess, the next question. It's a good segue. This comes from Andreas. And I'm going to kind of lead in a little bit with this. You mentioned working with the big Swiss refiners. There was a great interview by Koos Jansen of Alex Stanzjak back in December, where he confirmed that he'd been on a trip with Jim Rickards the month earlier, and they'd been to all four Swiss refiners. They're all running 24/7. Refining London bars into Asian kilo bars, and that lately they've been getting a lot of really old bars at the vaults. This guy said, I think the vaults in London are about empty because we're getting bars with date stamps of 1950s and 1960s. And I would say, you know, that's another reason why the GOFO rates are negative all the time now. With that as a whole lead in to Andreas's question, what Andreas's question is, since we are using old bars from the early 60s, as confirmed in the Swiss refineries, would James care to speculate on how much longer this gold manipulation can last if we are, in fact, starting to, in a sense, run out of physical gold?
Well, you know, that's the million-dollar question.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing what's been happening because we've been in backwardation for so long, in and out of backwardation. You know, for months on end here, you know, going back to last year. And there are times when, you know, I'm following the prices on my screen here in London, which comes directly to me from banks. And even though the LBMA doesn't report the backwardation, you know, I see the backwardation in terms of what the banks are offering me for spot versus what the banks are offering me for, you know, a month forward or something like that.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of stress in the physical market. There's no doubt. And when you recognize that physical metal is different than a promise to pay physical metal, and you recognize that we're operating a fractional reserve system where there's so much more paper claims to gold than there's actual physical gold, it has to run out sometime. I don't think the trigger, though, to the money bubble is going to be a run on the gold banks. That will come later in the process. That's typically what happens. You know, when you're in a monetary crisis, if you look back to the 1930s as an example, what happens is people move from illiquid forms of financial assets to more liquid forms of financial assets. You know, they moved out of bank accounts into cash, U.S. dollar cash currency. And at the last stages of the crisis, they moved out of cash currency into physical gold coins because people didn't even believe the cash currency anymore. That's how bad the conditions were. And I think that's what's likely to repeat this time as well, that, you know, you're going to see that last blow off in gold when people start to understand that there isn't enough physical gold to meet all of the claims at that current price. So, you know, I guess, you know, the answer to the this question is that I don't think it's going to be orderly at the last stages, and what will likely trigger it is a, you know, I'm really thinking that China now is going to be the trigger. The shadow banking market in shadow lending market in China is on the verge of, you know, collapsing, and you know, there's just not enough credit. There's too many bad loans that were made there. And, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why the Chinese have been buying all of this gold. They realize that the currency is troubled, the banking system in that country is troubled, and they want to get into physical metal as a safe haven, particularly given that the metals are so cheap.
And I would think giving them a leg up rather than just being subject to the dollar system and having that all collapse, it gives them a leg up on the new system, whether they dictate the terms or not. It's certainly wise for them to have it. James, this next question comes from Jim. He's got a couple. It's kind of a two-part question, but again, the first one kind of leads into what we were just talking about. He wants to know if when you get orders, is gold money having any difficulty sourcing gold to fill client purchases? And then his second part is just about the business in general. How's gold money doing? Is it continuing to grow? 2013 impacted at all? So there's your two questions. Are you having any trouble getting gold? Any unusual delays? And how's business?
Yeah, we have established relationships with the refiners, and we're able to get physical metal. And we say to our customers, if we don't have physical metal, we're not going to tell you that we're going to get it next week or 2 weeks or something like that in the future. We only sell it if we have it on hand in our own inventory. Now, when we're buying physical metal, we're buying maybe $1 million or $2 million at a time, and that's not a big stretch for a refiner. First of all, because they know what our flow of business is, so they'll make available, you know, two or three bars, knowing that we're going to be coming in and buying it on an ongoing basis. So from our point of view, we've been not having difficulty. If you were a big institution who wanted to buy $50 million of physical metal, you'd have a very, very difficult time doing that, particularly in this market. You know, being involved in the physical market for many, many years, there's a rule of thumb that I follow. It's very easy to sell physical metal, but when you're buying in size, it's very difficult to buy in size. And by size, I mean, you know, if you're an institutional player or a super rich person who's trying to diversify your portfolio, particularly in this market, it's very, very difficult to get physical metal in size. You have to remember that every day there's like 8 or 9 tons of new metal coming into the market from the mining companies. And that new metal coming into the market from the mining companies, you know, can take care of a lot of small players in the market. You know, even though we're storing a lot of metal, we consider ourselves to be a small player compared to some of these big institutions are out there. With regard to gold money, you know, 2013, like everybody in the gold business, was a difficult year. You know, volumes were down. We continue to have customer growth now. We continue to increase the weight of metals in the vault. And, you know, my expectation is that this is going to be a very good year for gold in terms of higher prices, which by implication means it's going to be good for the industry. Not only, you know, sellers of physical metal like gold money, but I think it's also going to be good for the mining companies as well.
Well, and now that leads right into Igor's question. That was his. About do you ever think about sourcing your just cutting out the LBMA, cutting out the COMEX or any other delivery system, and just striking a deal with some miners for their production that then you just ship straight off to a refiner and set it up that way? Is that a possibility for a company like yours?
You know, we've looked at this and considered it, but you know, the bullion banks have such hooks into the refiners that it's basically impossible to do that.
There you go.
You know, it might change in the future, but you know, the refiners want to get that miners want to get that money long before the refining process is finished. So, you know, typically what will happen is the doré leaves the mine and the bullion bank is in there giving the miner money for the doré bar subject to whatever the final refining results are based on the weight of metal that comes out of the refiner. That, you know, that process is well established. It's going to be difficult for anyone like Gold Money or anybody else in the business to deal directly with the miners.
Yeah, I believe it. All right, I better keep on chugging along. I got several questions left. You've already been extremely generous with your time, and I know we all very much appreciate it. On to Robert's question. Big fan, he says. He's a Gold Money member, but wanted to know what precious metals inventory reporting goes to IRS and various other sovereign agencies. Do you have to report everybody's positions and that kind of stuff and sales, or is there like a dollar limit or anything like that, James?
Yeah, he's talking about what gold money reporting does, and the simple answer is there is none. because we are a European company. We, you know, we operate in the island of Jersey and in the United Kingdom, and there are privacy laws over here in Europe where you don't, you know, report or share, you know, confidential personal data. So there is no reporting done by Gold Money.
That's good to know. I think that's the answer he was probably looking for.
There's also a practical point of view on this one because, you know, we've got customers in 100 different countries around the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, we can't be, you know, filling in forms for, you know, various governments. So if there are reporting requirements, what we do in our customer agreement, we say the burden is the customer's, it's not ours. There's no other practical way of knowing, you know, what the rule of law is or what the rules are in, you know, so many different countries around the world. And we, like I say, we have customers in over 100 different countries.
All right, this next one comes from Gavin, and this looks like kind of a hedging question, but he says, hi, James, with regards to Gold Money, how are your exposures and positions managed? Hypothetically, say there was a mini melt-up, and gold goes to $4,000 an ounce, and all of a sudden 80% of your customers decide they want to sell their gold. How do you manage to absorb all that, and I mean, what kind of hedging processes do you employ as a company?
Yeah, we don't hedge. You know, what Gold Money's working capital is comprised of is a certain amount of national currencies, and we try to keep those to a minimum because we don't want the exposure of, you know, having money in a bank and then getting bailed in by some government somewhere. And inventory of various precious metals, which I try to keep at a, you know, at a maximum because there's less risk holding precious metals than there is holding national currencies. Now, every person who owns metal in Gold Money, regardless of the size or the weight of metal that they own, that metal is in a vault wherever they've chosen to store it. And regardless of the size, it can be sold right away. There's a limit as to how much we will take online 24/7. And if it's above that limit, what we do is we then sell for the customer on the PM fix as soon as the next PM fix after he puts in his order to sell. And because there's essentially no limit as to how much can be sold in a PM fix, the metal will be sold. And it goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's very easy to sell physical metal. It's very difficult to buy it when you're buying in size. So we can just do anything. We have the access to the fix that we can basically sell any metal that we need, any customer needs to sell. If we don't absorb it for our own inventory, we just do it on the fix. And we tell the customer that when he puts the order in,
yeah,
you know, what we're taking for ourselves, if any, or what's going to go on the fix. And we explain to him in the response to his order exactly what he can expect.
Being very simple and straight on the up and up, so everyone understands where they are.
Yeah, and very transparent. It's very,
yes,
transparent as well, because everybody knows what the fixed price is when it finally happens.
Right. All right, James, this was for this one. Next one's from a guy who goes by the name of Coaster. If you just had to estimate, your best guess, because nobody knows, how much gold do you think Russia has? And I'm going to throw in China, too. You just have a guess? Just your personal guess?
Yeah. I think Russia, what they report, is probably fairly close to what they really have. They probably have a little bit, you know, outside the system, just, you know, extra, you know, secret reserves. So I don't think there's much there to be, you know, to expect that it's different than what's reported. China, on the other hand, I would not be surprised if they have over 3,000 tons. This is, I'm talking about the government here.
Yeah.
And the reason why I say that is, you know, going back to the late 1990s even, when China was only reporting to the IMF something like 300 tons, I had a discussion with an individual who was a dealer that was doing a lot of business with China. And this guy understood China inside and out. And he said back then even that they probably already had 1,000 tons.
Hmm.
You know, that's 15 years ago.
Hmm.
And given all the metal that's been flowing to China, given all of the increase in production that they've been doing over the last 15 years, I think 3,000 tons is probably a fairly conservative estimate. So you're getting up there to the size that would enable them to have a credible amount of metal if they did want it back to one with currency. The only question is what price would it would have to be, and it would have to be a high enough price to attract people to use their yuan and or use the metal and exchange it for yuan, like what happened in the 1930s in the States. You know, the U.S. devalued the dollar from $20.67 to $35. It'd have to be a sizable devaluation. And in terms of numbers, you know, I'm saying I think $10,000 to $12,000 an ounce is a fair value for gold at present.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of number I'm thinking of.
All right. We're starting to get deep into this a little bit. And again, I want to be respectful of your time, James. So I'll just hit you with just a couple more real quick. This one comes from, I believe this one is, I want to make sure I got this one's from Clarkey. From your understanding, what are the ramifications of Basel III and the potential elevation of gold to a tier one asset? Does this mean gold becomes convertible as currency and thus could be exchanged for purchase of goods and assets tax-free? If not, what does tier one mean?
Yeah, it's sort of interesting that a lot of this Basel III, I think, has been overstated in terms of the impact. You know, gold has been on bank balance sheets for quite some time. If you look at a central bank, for example, gold is the most liquid asset on the bank's balance sheet. So it's already, you know, considered to be the best form of money. And it's basically true also for, you know, the banking system as a whole. I don't think it necessarily means anything in terms of, you know, backing currencies or convertibility or anything of that nature. The big stumbling block to returning to gold is not the BIS, but the International Monetary Fund. The U.S. changed the rules of the International Monetary Fund back in the late 1970s when it was, you know, really propagandizing against gold, saying that, you know, gold could not be part of any country's monetary system if that country was a member of the IMF. And that rule still basically prevails. So, you know, if a country is going to go back to gold, either the IMF has to change or the country is going to have to pull out of the IMF, or the country is going to have to say, I don't care what the IMF says, you know, the dollar isn't worth being the world's reserve currency anymore. We're going to go back to gold anyway.
Here's a quick one about being a business that's domiciled, I guess, in New Jersey. Is that right?
We're in the island of Jersey. Which is
island of Jersey.
Island.
That's what that means.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Well, this guy, Jim, wants to know why that is and is that safe and what's the rationale behind that?
Yeah, the rationale is that there's a lot greater respect for private property in Europe than there is in other parts of the world. And, you know, the U.S., ever since its confiscation of gold back in 1933, has had a very strong anti-gold point of view. So it's not very friendly to open a company like Gold Money in the United States, in my view. So, you know, I've lived in seven different countries around the world. I've traveled to over 50. You know, so back in the late 1990s, when I was looking at places where to establish Gold Money, I wanted to go into a place that was reliant upon Anglo-Saxon common law. And the reason why I wanted that is because the basis of Anglo-Saxon common law is property rights.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in this business, you want to know that everyone's property is protected. And Jersey, we hired a consulting firm to say which country was the best one to do it. And the consulting firm came back and said Jersey, because of the respect for private property in that part of the world. It's also a safe geopolitical location. You know, we're in the middle of the English Channel. So it's part of the United Kingdom. So that was the rationale for establishing the business in Jersey at the time.
It's interesting. I didn't know any of that. I think that's really interesting. That's great. All right. Just a couple of quickies. Maybe this is quickie. One more from Rob, who says he's bugging out and getting out of the USA permanently next month. And so can you just give a quick rundown on the process of taking his physical metal that he has, delivering it to Gold Money, costs maybe involved in that. He's got a big, diverse collection of numismatics and semi-numismatics. And how do you consolidate all this? How does he get this to you guys? How do you guys store it and take it from there for him?
Okay, well, first of all, you know, numismatics are not money. They're really an investment because you have the premium of the coin collecting value over and above the bullion content of the bullion of the coin itself. And gold money does not get involved in numismatics in any way. So he would probably have to go to a specialist coin dealer that deals in numismatics and either, you know, sell them for bullion or, you know, exchange it for bullion or just, you know, sell them and get the cash and then buy bullion with it with it later. We've had customers in the States who have shipped bullion from the States to the vaults. It can be arranged. We've done it in the past. There are certain minimum amounts because it doesn't make sense financially for a customer to do it unless the minimum amounts are met. And they can contact Gold Money and they'll give you all of the details. But when it comes from outside of the what's called the chain of integrity, the gold has to be refined and then turned into bars that meet the gold money chain of integrity. You know, this is what we were talking before about the scanning and all of that.
Right.
So it can be done. I would say though that if you do it, you're going to ship it through one of the shippers like Brinks or Secure Transport. But based on the experience that I've heard at feedback from other people in the States who've done it, you're going to get a call from the FBI because they want to know whether you're involved in money laundering.
I suppose that's true. So perhaps, I mean, is it, I guess, you know, maybe not what he wants to do, but is it best just to convert it into cash and then send you cash and get restarted? Is that the easiest way to do it?
Well, then there are tax consequences.
Well, yeah, then you got that too, yeah.
Taxpayer. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you take the bullion exchange it for bullion overseas, you know, then you're doing like for like. And I'm not a tax expert and I can't really give tax advice, but I've always been told that if you're exchanging bullion for bullion, like for like there are
like.
No tax consequences.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I would imagine, Robert, just contact Gold Money. They'll walk you through it. All right. Last two. One, since you store all four main precious metals, gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, if someone were to dedicate, say they wanted to have 20% of their assets in metals, I mean, do you have a personal allocation recommendation? I mean, do you try to put some in each? What's your personal thoughts, James?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, you know, gold is money. That's why it has value. Silver, on the other hand, is both an industrial metal and a monetary metal. You know, 63 ounces of silver at current rates does exactly for you what 1 ounce of gold does. It has money outside the banking system. Now, the problem with silver is that because it has this two different demands, industrial and monetary, you get volatility. And you see this volatility by the gold-silver ratio moving up and down. You know, back in 2011, when silver was at $50 an ounce, it took 30 ounces of silver to equal 1 ounce of gold. Now we're at 63, 64 ounces of silver. So that volatility is not for everybody. So what I recommend is that for your precious metals portfolio, buy gold first. If you're prepared to take the volatility, then buy silver. And typically what I recommend is to have two-thirds or so or three-quarters in gold and then the balance in silver. Now, the platinum and palladium are also precious metals, but they don't have any monetary history.
Right.
So you can own them as a form of diversification, but there are advantages. You know, some people buy platinum because platinum was never confiscated by governments. That's not to say it won't happen in the future, but if you're worried about gold confiscation, maybe you should have 5 or 7 or 8% of your allocation of your metals portfolio in platinum and or palladium. But recognize that, you know, the PGMs, they're industrial metals. Their value goes principally because of industrial demand. But if you have a monetary collapse in the future, maybe the precious, maybe the PGMs, the platinum group metals, will rise quite substantially as well. So view them as a form of diversification. There's one other thing while we're on this subject that might be useful to people. The question is, how much precious metals do you want to own? The rule of thumb I use is that you have precious metals equal to your age. So if like me, you're 67, you should have 67% of your portfolio in precious metals, and then the balance should be in investments of whatever sort. Because you have to remember, and this is explained very well in the book, that money and investments are entirely different things. And what you want to distinguish between is how much liquidity you want, which is your money, and then how many investments you want. So if you're younger, you might want to take a risk and have more investments. But as you get older, you want to be more conservative, take less risk. Therefore, you want to own more precious metals, particularly because they're so cheap right now and undervalued. That's definitely the conservative approach.
Yeah, more stuff that you need to insure as well as you're older too.
Yes.
All right. And lastly, Derek wants to know, this is kind of a gold porn question in a way, James, for lack of a better term. In the business that you're in, what's the most gold you've ever been around at one time? Where you just look around and it's just everywhere.
Well, I've been in the vault in the Federal Reserve.
Oh, really?
I have the one in New York. But it's interesting. Because when you go down there, they tell you they have these tunnels, which are arched. They're probably about 8 feet, 7 feet high, or thereabouts, and maybe at the base about another 7 or 8 feet, and then they come to the center as an arch. And they tell you that these tunnels, and they're lined up against each other, go yards and yards into the granite or the bedrock where they're built. But the interesting thing is that you only see the front of what's at the beginning of the tunnel, which is a stack of bars from floor to ceiling. You can't see row 2 or row 3 or row 100 that's supposedly there.
Right.
So, in terms of being in a vault where there's been a lot of metal, if the metal is really there in the Federal Reserve, that would probably be the vault where I've seen the most metal, because it supposedly has something like at the present time, something like 6,500 tons of gold in that one vault. But I've also been in vaults in Switzerland, bank vaults, and that is quite a fabulous experience. If you've seen these pictures of the Queen of England walking through the Bank of England vault, it's a very similar type of thing that you'll see in some of the big banks in Switzerland. And maybe not just all big bars like the Bank of England had in that vault with the Queen, but you'll see a lot of small bars, kilo bars, and even coins and things like that in the vaults as well.
Just laying around, just all over the place.
Yeah, stacked.
Stacked.
Organized and very orderly. Typically, the Swiss will know where every little coin is and they'll have a record for it. I'm not so sure that's what they do at the Federal Reserve in New York.
Yeah, the Germans might have some doubts as well at this point. James.
Yeah, that whole German experience is really quite something. The fact that they've only delivered 5 tons in the first year should raise everybody's eyebrows around the world and sort of say what's going on, why haven't they delivered it? In my mind, you have to consider that the gold might be there, but the Fed has this view, I think, that possession is 9/10 of the law. And they're only going to let go of that gold, very, very grudgingly.
Yeah. And I think, too, that they immediately re-refined it, whether it was here in the U.S., as they originally stated, or back in Germany. It just tells you what kind of gold they're getting back. I mean, all of that U.S. gold is listed in the 90% category on all the spreadsheets that the Treasury Department put out. And here Germany wants it back, in the 4.9 type bars going forward. It just makes you wonder. And like I said, the 5 metric tons in all of 2013 is a real head scratcher too. I mean, James, you in your experience with the Swiss refiners, is what Alex Stanchek reported back in Jim Rickards reported back in December, is that consistent with what they're telling you too about running 24/7?
Yeah, it is consistent. But the real measure is not running 24/7. The real measure is what's the backlog.
Yeah.
Back in April and May last year, the Swiss refiners were running backlogs up to 3 months. The backlogs have been worked down, and they're only running now for a few, several weeks or a little bit less. So they're still busy, But it's the backlogs that's the real measure as to just how busy they really are. And it's not quite the peak that we saw back in April, May last year. But they're still running 24/7 and they still have backlogs.
Okay, fair enough. Well, James, thank you very, very, very much. I had just tremendous amount of information that you've shared with us. And I know everybody listening just really appreciates it. And so I want to pass that along too and just say thank you. And that I wish you a prosperous 2014. Tell everybody again about the book, The Money Bubble, available at all your bookstores and online and everything else.
Yeah, it's available online. We've gotten a lot of good reviews on Amazon already, and it's selling very, very well. It's also available at your local bookstore. If they don't have it, it can be ordered through your local bookstore. And it's called The Money Bubble, What to Do Before It Pops.
And two big thumbs up for me. And it's fresh information. I mean, you guys must have just finished writing it a couple of months ago.
Yeah, it came out in January in printed form. It came out the end of December in Kindle form first, and it is very fresh. You know, we basically finished it in December, and we think that we were rushing it. We basically did it within a period of about 4 months, maybe a little bit more, which is quite a short time to write a book of this length. But we wanted to rush it because everything that we were researching and what we were concluding was suggesting that the precious metals were at a low last year, and more to the point that 2014 was going to be a very, very good year on the upside for the precious metals, and generally for the whole gold industry and for individuals who were involved in gold, either by owning bullion or perhaps even owning some of the mining stocks. It was going to be a good year.
And it is so far. You're absolutely right. And the book is just tremendous. And so I want to encourage everybody to pick it up. James, thank you so much. I hope we can visit again soon. But until then, please keep doing what you do. We really appreciate all you do for us.
Okay. I'd be happy to chat with you again in the future. Just let me know. It's always an honor to be on your show. I've enjoyed it in the past, and I'm sure I'll enjoy it in the future as well. And hopefully you found my answers useful and helpful.
Just great stuff. Thank you, James. Have a great rest of your day.
Okay, you too. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.